and his text was, Arno Dali is 9 pounds of sausage in an 8 pound sack. which I think is a pretty good descriptor for the visual, the aesthetic of Arno Dali in a Peloton. Welcome back to the Placeholder Podcast, everybody. I'm Kaylee Fretz. We're actually recording on Sunday, February 26th, but you're not going to get this until Tuesday, right around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, my local time, Colorado time. And I'm going to explain why in just a little bit. But we do have a great show for you today. We're going to talk Kern-Brussels-Kern, which was this morning. We're going to talk Omloop. We're going to talk the impending battle between Jonas Vingegaard and Tadej Pogacar. We're going to talk about a helmet with a pocket on it, or some straps, or something like that. We'll get to that later in the show. Joining me today, Dane Cash, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you doing, Kaylee?
I'm excellent. And Kate Wagner, how are you, Kate?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. I'm really good. And Ronan McLaughlin, how are you? Your team just won the Carabao Cup. You must be ecstatic.
Yeah, but like before we get into football or soccer, depending on what you call it, I just want to clear up one thing. It's Kurna. It's not Kern. It's Kurna. Kurna. Yes. If we're going to talk about it, we have to talk about it right.
This is good because
this is very important.
On the other show, we talked about the Clásica Jaén, and I feel like we gave a little pronunciation, you know, class. And I think on this podcast we have four different, you know, linguistic abilities, and that's good. We've got the Flemish Dutch in Rona, we have our French in Kaylee, and Slovenian with Kate. And I think between the four of us, I guess we're missing Italian, but we could probably properly pronounce most big races on the calendar. So that's good.
The good news is Italians didn't do much this weekend. I don't know if we're gonna have to. Yeah. I think we'll be all right. I think we'll be all right. All right, Kurne. Kurne? Kurne. Kurne. You have to kind of act angry.
I like
how
that.
Do I do this, Ronan?
Yeah, well, like it is Belgium, so yes, angry is good.
All right, I'll
just
do my best.
Channel your inner anger and gray, and you have it.
Okay. I don't really. I live in Colorado. I don't have an inner gray. I don't know what that is. Anyway, before we get into today's show, the other very big, very important announcement for today's podcast is that right as you are getting this podcast, we are finally launching our media empire. All four of us on this episode are involved, along with a whole bunch of other fantastic writers, reporters, podcasters. This is the Escape Collective, and that's what I want you to do right this very second, is hit pause, head over to escapecollective.cc on the browser of your choice, and sign up. What this is kind of like a Kickstarter, basically, and the idea is that we don't want to kick this thing off as some half-baked venture where, frankly, you don't get kind of what you're paying for, right? Where you don't get the wholesale coverage that you want out of us. So what we need to do here is we need every single one of you out there to sign up. That will ensure the viability of this product. It's basically as simple as that. We have essentially membership targets that we need to hit to make this thing viable from a financial perspective. We're going to be funding ourselves almost entirely through you. That is through readers, listeners, the audience, the people consuming the content. We are not going to be taking very many ads at all. And so we need you. We need you to sign up in droves, because otherwise this project, which we've spent months planning and figuring out, it won't happen. It just won't, because that's the whole model. The whole model is we sell directly to the people who want the content. So hopefully that's you. Hopefully if you've been listening to this podcast over the last couple of months, you kind of know our story. You know what happened to a lot of us. You know where we come from, and you want to see what we can do going forward.
I think it's a great plan. What you just said, it sounds like a really good idea. Everybody should try it.
I think that it's a big step forward in the world of cycling journalism, which has taken quite some hits lately, and we got to hit back.
Yeah, well, I think I'm just about as excited as the rest of you, but I am fairly new to all this, having just wandered on here recently and having spent the last month being a full-time bike rider again for probably the last time ever. So, Katie, you mentioned there, like, this is going to be quite different, but, you know, I think it's probably worth expanding on that, I think, a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think the content will actually feel quite familiar at first. We have some fantastic reporters, writers, photographers lined up for this. I mean, you and Dave Rome top that list, right? We're going to have the best and most trustworthy tech coverage and reviews. We're going to have phenomenal reporting from European bike racing. We love European bike racing. It's one of the most beautiful sports on the planet, and there's just an endless stream of stories to tell from there. But we also want to expand out beyond that. We want to dive into bike packing, which is something that has kind of grabbed the imagination of a lot of the crew that are coming on. And we're also going to pick up some new and really interesting names. You might actually spot a couple of them on the splash page. Folks that have been in that space for a long time and are experts in that space and will provide amazing content in that space. We want to kind of dive into mountain bikes too. We love mountain bikes. I ride mountain bikes at least half the time, if not more. And we think that there's a dearth of coverage in the sort of like non-gravity bits of mountain biking. We think that there's not a whole lot of entities out there doing really good cross-country coverage. We think that there's opportunities in a lot of these areas. I should reiterate, you know, at first it's going to feel familiar. We don't want to expand too fast. We don't want to step into spaces until we know we can do them properly. Because again, if we can't do them properly, then we've failed you. But once we feel like we do them properly, and once we get the membership numbers to trigger steps into these other areas, because that's basically how it's going to work. You know, I've got member numbers that are basically revenue numbers that trigger stepping into some of these other spaces, like transport and utility cycling and advocacy, for example. That's one that I'm really excited about. That we can't, honestly, we cannot afford it today, but it's on the roadmap. And the second we get to a certain member number, we'll step into that space and we'll do it better than anybody. We're going to have the world's best tech coverage. We're going to have reviews that you can truly trust because, again, we are working for you in all of this. We're not working for the industry. We're not trying to sell your eyeballs to somebody else. We are just making the best content we can for you. And I think that really starts to solve some of the trust problem that cycling media has had for a very long time. You know, every time we run a survey, we get lots of responses, people saying, I just don't trust bike reviews. I don't trust shoe reviews. I don't trust any of it because I wonder what you're trying to sell me. Half of it's affiliate links, right? So you're clicking on something and the media entity is actually getting a cut of that, which means they have an incentive to put those particular things in a roundup for you. We're not going to do any of that stuff because for us to be successful from a financial perspective, we need to make content that you can trust and that you truly enjoy. So that's going to be, I mean, that's our North Star. That is everything to us. We have to make the absolute best content for all of you out there or else we will fail. And we know that. And I think we can do it. You know, we've got the best team here. We have some of the best writers in cycling. I mean, Kate is a perfect example on this podcast with us today. Popped up kind of out of nowhere in the bike world a couple years ago, was clearly and obviously just a phenomenal writer. And we snapped her up. There's a reason why she's on this podcast. There's a reason why her name is on the splash page at escapecollective.cc. You know, Ian Trelor is back. Of course, we've got to have Ian. You can't not have Ian. He's another one of those writers, reporters who just is a step above most of the rest. It's all about surprising you, delighting you, making you feel something, making you want to get out and ride your bike, making you comfortable in a purchase decision. That's what it's all about for us. And if we're successful there, we hope that essentially you will reward us by by signing up and keeping this thing afloat. That's the whole goal. And we're gonna just seek to surprise you every single morning when you get up. And Escape will feel different from anything else out there. And if it doesn't, I don't know, I'll put my hand up as the editor-in-chief and say, I have failed all of the editors here and all of you out there. And so call me on it. If you think that we are drifting away from that mission, I want you to call me on it.
Yeah, I was actually sitting watching the Manchester United match earlier and flicking through Google News or something. I think I opened a new browser page and Google News popped up and suggested this article for me. And it was from, I can't remember who it was from, but it was a football story anyway, so it wasn't anybody that we know or anything. But the headline was, Ten Hag confirms this Manchester United forward will miss the Carabao Cup final. And I looked at it and I was like, that is the most clickbait headline I think I've ever seen. And I actually just refused to click on it because I knew when I click on that, what's on the other side is probably paragraphs upon paragraphs that didn't actually give me any of the information that I clicked on. And as I wasn't clicking on it, it occurred to me this is exactly what we are doing, is like we're ensuring that that sort of stuff never comes to cycling and that you just, when you actually go on to escapecollective.cc, let's say that over and over again, you'll be getting the kind of content that you actually want to engage with rather than the kind of content that makes you angry like I was. Haven't seen
that. Was it Jadon Sancho? Who was it?
I'm assuming it was going to be Rashford, who actually did start the match but was rumored to be injured. So I don't know because the headline did not tell me and I did not click on it.
No, that's 100% the point. And the reason why that story exists is because the model incentivizes
page
high volume clickbait, right? Because they need so many eyeballs to hit that website to make any money at all to keep those journalists employed, to keep the entire entity running, right? The nice thing about what we're trying to build is that high volume. Like, yeah, we'd love to have a giant audience, and we absolutely endeavor to have a huge audience that has a huge amount of impact on the cycling world. But I don't need the extra 10,000 clicks that not including the athlete's name in the headline gets me, right? Because what I actually need is for you to come away from that story thinking, I'm glad I clicked on that because I need your money, Ronan. Or you know, whoever the reader might be, that's the way that we're going to operate, and it's the fundamental reason why the switch in incentive is what's going to make it's going to essentially like free up all of us content creator types to make the best stuff we can.
It's worth mentioning also, I'm almost certain had I clicked on that article, there would have been at least two or three autoplay videos that I did not want to listen or watch, and God knows how many other ads that I did not want to see. And you know, that is not okay anywhere, but it's like slightly more tolerable when you know chances are whoever was advertising on that page would not have been, you know, directly influencing football either. But in a sort of niche sport like ours, if you have those sorts of ads not popping up and I'm supposed to be also a tech writer, then that's when the lines get blurred. And that's why I think what we're doing is even more important, is that it actually frees me up to write about time trial helmets and aerodynamics, and it frees Dave to write about tools. And you know, it gives all of us license to do what we love rather than what we are told we have to do.
And if we don't do those things, or if you do click a story and there's four autoplay videos that you hate, you mentioned this, Kaylee, but just to hit this again, you can get on Discord and you can shout at us. You can send us messages. They go right to my phone. I have Discord. I have the Discord app on my phone so that I'll be walking around town and then I can get a message from somebody that says, hey, I got four autoplay videos. What the heck? And I'm going to listen to that more often than if I just saw a comment on a website, which I would probably just ignore because that's kind of what I'm conditioned to do by reading these comments at a lot of sites like this. I just ignore them. But this is different. You can talk to us.
Yeah, and like I said, the big thing is that we're just the business incentive shift, and so it frees up our journalists to do to do much deeper work. You know, Ronan, you kind of hinted at it there, but the sort of underlying editorial philosophy of this is an aggregation of niches, right? Where we want to allow editors to just dive as deep as they possibly can go into a particular area and find the audience in that area, find the other people out there, the listeners out there, the readers out there that are interested in that particular area. And if you want that stuff, we want to be the absolute best place for you to go to get whatever that topic is. So that's the sort of underlying strategy from an editorial perspective. And I think it's going to make for some really, really good, really interesting, really deep writing and reporting that you're not going to find anywhere else. So I don't need to talk anymore about this right now. You're going to hear us shout about it for a while. Forever, actually, but we're really going to shout extra loud for a little while, because this early sort of member drive, basically, this is going to determine whether this project happens or not. We have a couple weeks here to get enough members to cover the costs of this project. This is a big deal. This next couple weeks is a huge deal, and I'm not kidding when I say pause. Head over to escapecollective.cc. Sign up. We'll love you forever for it. Like, genuinely. And
come back. Hit play again. Don't forget to hit play again. You have to.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You got to hit play again after. Yeah.
There is a full episode coming.
Wade and I will. We're going to do a longer episode on the sort of like business and editorial strategy behind this for anybody who's interested. We don't want to go again crazy, crazy deep on that right now. But keep an eye out for that later this week a little bit. With another name, actually, who's going to be involved with this project that you will not have heard yet, but I'm really, really excited about. So, with that...
Just a quick note, there's other podcasts coming, too. Just, you know, just tease that, maybe. There's things to look for on the podcast network. Yeah.
There are more podcasts coming. More podcasts coming in the short term. If you would like them to stay around in the long term, please go sign up. All right, let's get into. We had opening weekend. We had a bunch of fantastic racing this weekend. I know some people will get angry at me, but for calling it opening weekend, because there's a bunch of races that have happened already. But I think all you have to do is sort of look at the collective stoke of the bike world in the last 72 hours to know that. Let's be honest, this is opening weekend.
Look at the crowds on the side of the road at UAE Tour, and then look at the crowds on the side of the road in Kurnen, Brussels, Kurnen. and yeah, discussion over.
So let's kick off with Omloop Het Nieuwsblad yesterday. So we had a men's and a women's race. We're gonna talk about both, obviously. I think this will actually be a slightly shorter section, because Kurnen Brussels Kurnen was more interesting to me this particular weekend. But let's start with Omloop. So this is where I turn to Dane, and you give us the very brief rundown of what happened. Let's start with the men's race, and we'll go chronological.
Yeah,
tell me what happened in the men's race yesterday, and we'll talk about it.
A bit of a running theme over the last 48 hours, and maybe one that will continue in the men's race at Omloop and then beyond. You know, Bovisma just dominant without Wout van Aert, and that's the big. You know, we talked to ahead of the race that Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel weren't going to be here, but we mentioned that Jumbo-Visma had quite a strong team. They got a guy who had just won Paris-Roubaix. That's a good thing to have. And a handful of other really strong riders. And they, yeah, did not disappoint. Dylan van Baarle, who hadn't raced yet this year. So I think there was at least some question if he was going to be, you know, in racing form. It's not easy to just go from training to, you know, getting thrown to the wolves in a opening weekend race. I'd say he managed to prove he's feeling pretty good. He attacked from, what was it, 40K? Out there, he kind of led the salvo, and nobody really had a chance to match him. He was just super strong all day, and just completely crushed it in the end. And Omloop went to a Jumbo-Visma rider in Van Baarle, and they also stuck another one on the podium in Christophe Laporte. So, heck of a performance from Jumbo-Visma.
I want to talk a little bit about Van Baarle's timing. Because the manner in which he won this race was actually sort of relatively similar to his Roubaix victory and a couple other decent-sized wins that he has had, in that he seems to have a knack for sneaking his way off the front in a moment that you wouldn't expect him to be able to. I mean, talking specifically about Saturday, like, it was a pretty large group when he headed out, and he was sort of initially followed by a couple of riders. Bahrain jumped on him, and yet he has this ability to just sort of cruise away. Like, keep, I don't know whether it's just straight power output or timing or anyway, I want to talk about it. What is it?
I think even more impressive than just his timing for the breakaway is actually, thanks to some app on my phone, I had the result for pretty much every race spoiled for me before I seen it. So I actually knew that Van Baarle had won before I actually got to sit down and watch the race. But anyway, what that actually helped me in doing was keeping an eye on Van Baarle for the sort of 60, 70 kilometers of coverage before that. And he's actually, and it's actually one area I think Jumbo-Visma might be coming away from the weekend, and as dominant as they were, thinking we can actually improve a heck of a lot. So that's a scary thought. I'll come back to that in a second. But Van Baarle has this, it's a skill that Peter Van Pettigen was sort of famous for, and just knowing when is the exact moment where I have to be at the front of the bunch. And Van Baarle was more than happy to, you know, he was sitting completely detached from the rest of his Jumbo-Visma teammates. He was like a sole Jumbo-Visma rider, quite near the middle and back of the bunch. Quite a lot of the coverage that we've seen before he actually made his attack. And that, you know, had he crashed or missed a split or something, you'd be saying that was a silly move. But actually, when it works out for him, you can't really argue with it. And there was one point coming onto one crucial cobble sector where he was almost at the back of the bunch coming onto it, got held up behind somebody else who had crashed, and it looked like, you know, this could be his race over here. But actually, I think he had just made the calculation that rather than waste so much energy trying to fight for a position at the front, I'm just going to be at the front when I need to be there. And then, yes, the move he made, perfectly timed also. You know, he's probably making that instant calculation that everybody's sort of on the limit just after a hard section. I've got two or three teammates here. If I make a move, it's sort of checkmate where I'm gone. I've got clear, and my teammates can like police the break behind, and that's exactly what happened in the end up. And those who did follow him just didn't have the legs to match the sort of power that Van Baarle could do on Saturday without looking like he was trying.
I mean, I think it also counts for a lot that he doesn't panic like ever. I mean, he stays remarkably level headed the entire time, and kind of almost emotionless. Like, you see him and you don't really see him struggle, or you don't really see him, you know, really, you know, sprint to just get to where he needs to be or something like this. He really becomes this very sort of calm, calculating presence. Almost, he almost becomes invisible. If he wasn't a favorite, like, you wouldn't notice him at all. And I think that has a lot to do with how he succeeds in breakaways, which I think is very different than, for example, like Mohoric or like Taco Vanderhorn, who are very chatty, you know, very animated, and, you know, kind of, they're always scheming or something like this. Whereas Van Baarle is just, he doesn't say anything to anyone. He's not so calculating, or he's not so visibly calculating. And I think that counts for a lot. He disappears.
I think the team aspect makes a big difference as well. And you pointed this out, but when he went on the, was it Molenberg, I guess, there was just Jumbo riders everywhere. And so if you have Christophe Laporte behind you, that makes a huge difference. I'm not saying that, like, I could win a race with Christophe Laporte behind me, but if Dylan Van Baarle is up there, he's definitely going to win a race with Christophe Laporte behind him. I mean, that's a really helpful thing to have.
His career kind of taken from 10,000 feet, I think, is really interesting as well, because, I mean, he's 30 years old now. So mm-hmm. So he's taken a sort of a very long time to kind of fully realize the potential that was indicated way back, you know, 6-7 years ago. You know, he's riding for, well, that version of EF at the time, the Slipstream, whatever Slipstream was called that year. I think it was just a Cannondale 3-pack or something like that. Anyway, it's taken him a long time to kind of get here. And I feel like because of that, because he's not one of these like 21-year-old phenoms that now we're sort of used to seeing, that he kind of gets overlooked a little bit. I mean, we had the defending Roubaix champion lining up for Omloop, and he wasn't really sitting at the top of people's minds as a favorite for Saturday.
Also, the thing with Jumbo-Visma is like, there's of course now lots of discourse about Jumbo-Visma, you know, after Pernod Brussels-Kerner and with these like really strong showings really early in the season. And the question that I was kind of asking myself about them is like, are they really that overpowered, or does everyone else just not kind of have it together? I mean, like, theoretically speaking, if you looked at both of those races, you know, it was totally possible to bring those breakaways back, and it didn't happen. No one could seem to get organized. And so I think this is an interesting question. Anyway, sorry, my dog is barking now.
I think a lot of teams will be looking at, this is the second year in a row that Jumbo-Visma have come into opening weekend without racing prior, at least not for the winners of Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, having raced prior to the Omloop. They've come in from altitude training camps in January or February, whenever it was, and straight away hit the ground running. And, you know, we could see, you know, there's nothing that will motivate change in pro cycling like someone winning a race. And having done this twice now, you could see a lot of other teams start doing similar. And that would have been unheard of, you know, even a couple of years ago. To come into the Omloop without having raced was just absolutely unthinkable. But Jumbo have proven now that it can be done. And, you know, this notion of, you know, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, the champions didn't race early in the season and there was only training races. And that, you know, those notions are often bandied about, like, almost as if there was no winner of those races back then. It was just everybody rolled to the finish line together as a hard training session. Like, but there would have been riders who were targeting those races back then the same way as there is now. The difference is now, with the World Tour and with points and all that, and with teams being just so much more professional as each year goes on, the level of the races leading into opening weekend, like the Tour Down Under, like UAE Tour, like San Juan, everything we've seen to this point is so high that it actually, I think it's got to the point now where those races are at such a level now, they're no longer of benefit for a rider trying to build to a classic season. They're, you know, they're of benefit to a rider who is going there to perform rather than a rider who is going there to look to lift their level a bit. And Katie, you had mentioned about Van Baarle, you know, having hit the scene, what was it, 5, 6, 7 years ago, won Tour of Britain with EF at that time. And obviously he is a super talent, but he's that type of rider, a classics rider for these, you know, really, really hard races that still tend to favour the older, more experienced, stronger rider. And it just takes you can burst onto the scene, you can win Tour of Britain, but then to make the transition to being a rider to win Roubaix, to win Dwars d'Or, to finish third in the World Championships, to win Omloop Het Nieuwsblad now, that's a transition that I don't think it happens like sprinters or like GC riders now, where they can come onto the scene much quicker. With that type of classics rider, you know, it really does take those extra years of stamina, they really can play their advantage. And I think that's just what we're seeing with Van Baarle now. The one thing I would say though, Kate, to your point about him being like emotionless and all, God, please show some emotion after you've won the race. He was interviewed afterwards and it was like, it was like he was being like asked by a teacher in maths class about, you know, what's the 7 times tables or something. He just rhymed something off and then like, okay, I'm done now.
He's been like that every single time I've ever talked to him. I mean, I went to a EF Cannondale, whatever, training camp ages ago. Would have been like 2017 or something like that. And sat down with him for like a half hour, sort of preseason, you know, catch up. And he never opened up. Or maybe that's him open. Like, he's just never, you know, a half an hour of chatting with this guy. And he's just like, you guys as reporters, you know this. Like, sometimes you do an interview and you kind of assume that it will turn into a conversation. So maybe you have enough questions for like, you know, you've got 5, 6, 7 questions,
yeah,
and the rest are kind of like they're follow-ups or they just become a conversation. And this is one of those instances where you ask the question, you get an answer to that question and nothing else.
Yep.
And you better have another question ready.
Yep.
That's what interviewing Dylan Van Baarle is like.
One wee caveat might be of interest is that I know having won Dwars d'Or Vlaanderen, what, 2 years ago now, he actually wanted to re-sign with Ineos Grenadiers then, and the Grenadiers weren't so keen on this idea. For whatever reason, whether it was money or whatever, I'm not sure. But then, surprise, surprise, he won Paris-Roubaix last April, and the Grenadiers were like, oh, okay, let's re-sign here. And Van Baarle was not so keen then for some idea. So you got to think, like, yes, they had Pidcock in sixth place on Saturday, but certainly Van Baarle could be a rider that the Grenadiers might miss. You know, they've got a fantastic team there, but, you know, apart from Pidcock, they're not really, they don't really have the classic superstar like Van Baarle is now on their roster for this spring.
I think it's really unusual, I think, to see a transfer like that where a rider wins a really big race, Roubaix being, I think, number one or number two biggest one-day race of the year, and then go to another team. That's just so unusual. So that I'm sure the Ineos Classics squad is pretty bummed that he isn't with them this year, because he ended up showing, yeah, he's a pretty good rider.
I want to talk about Arnaud Delis. Dane, you mentioned Delis before this weekend. It's been clear that he is an enormous talent for a little bit of time here, but he's still incredibly young. And he hadn't kind of shown it at the, I guess, the pointy end of the biggest days just yet. And, you know, this, granted, this wasn't Flanders, but still, it's a pretty damn big bike race. He was super impressive. He was incredibly impressive. What else do we know about him? What else can you tell us about Arnaud Delis? Is he the real deal?
Yeah, so first and foremost, thank you for giving me the props there that I asked for. I appreciate that. That was nice. You didn't have to do that. Thank you. Second of all, in terms of who is he, you know, what do we need to know about him? One very useful, important piece of information about him is that he is a Walloon. And that is rare for classics stars from Belgium. There's basically Philippe Gilbert, and that's it. I mean, there's not a lot of other Walloon stars at the moment. Riders from the French-speaking part of Belgium. So Arnaud Delis, the Walloon Hope. According to Wikipedia, his nickname is the Walloon Bull. I don't know how true that is, but I read it on Wikipedia.
I have an old friend texted me this morning, and his text was, Arnaud Delis is 9 pounds of sausage in an 8-pound sack. which I think is a pretty good descriptor for the visual, the aesthetic of Arnaud Delis in a Peloton. I think that's and I don't even think it's an insult. I think it's like, it's actually kind of a compliment. he's not quite built like a lot of the other bike racers in a professional Peloton these days.
I think he's just built like a guy who is going to get this done no matter what it takes. If it's a spring race in the next decade, he's going to find a way to win it somehow. I think is whenever I look at him, that's what I see, is just, yes, power, yes, strength, yes, all those, but he's also just got grit and determination.
I think that's really showed,
bad
too.
Crash.
Because he crashed, right, and his sprint was really impressive. I mean, the fact that he was able to win the sprint for second place, obviously I'm sure he was hoping to win the race, and he actually was the betting favorite slightly when I last checked before the race. But the sprint wasn't the only thing. I mean, I think people might have thought about him as a guy who was going to win, maybe if this race comes down to a bunch kick. But to me, he looked like a guy who very much could have won the race in a number of scenarios. He was going up the climbs and showing a lot of power on the climbs as well. And to come back from a crash to finish that well, I think that's a really good sign for him and for his team, which really needs a win. I mean, this is a team that has, I don't just mean they need to win a bike race. They need a moral win, because to get bumped down to the second division after all those years is tough. And I think Lotto's got to be pleased that he has shown so quickly. Yeah, he can hang in these big races.
He basically had all of their points last year. So
he's crazy prolific. Like, if you look at his stat sheet on Pro Cycling Stats or Pro Cycling or whatever, like the number, he finished in the top 10 of various starts, for all of his starts, like 29 times. Like, that's insane. He had 9 wins. I mean, he just is, like, so prolific. And also, like, he climbed on the Mur in the big ring.
Yes. Yes. He went up the Mur in the big ring.
He's bleeding all over the place, climbing in the big ring. It's like, oh, yeah, this kid has got some spite locks now.
I will say that, like, he was given a sort of second-tier program for a lot of last year. So a lot of those races that he won were, they weren't Omloop. it was basically points farming. And that's why when I said earlier that this is like one of the first times he's kind of shown himself at the real pointy end of an event at this stature. There were some exceptions, like I think he was 10th at Le Semin mm-hmm. last year and a couple other relatively large races. But so he is the real deal. That's what it comes down to, is he is going to be a name that we come back to frequently. And I think for I think that's good. I think he's an entertaining rider. I mean, he was entertaining over the weekend. Yeah, those spite watts make for good watching.
Can we also talk about Mathis Lebert, who was the last one with Van Baarle? And he was in the break all day, and then like Van Baarle drops, you know, everyone else who's with him except for this like guy from Brittany that like only like under 23 watchers would know about. And he like was really with him except for then he like his, I don't know, his chain dropped or something and he just went backwards and that was it. And it was like, damn.
But he was also the other guy, the only guy in the move with Van Baarle who was using his head. You know, the rest of them, Vermeersch and I can't recall all the names now, but they were all riding through with Van Baarle, and Van Baarle was like literally ripping the legs off them. And surprise, surprise, as soon as it went uphill again, he dropped them one by one. Whereas, and forgive me, I've forgotten his name now, but he's a NeoPro from RKS Amzik. The rider you're referencing there, Kate, he was just...
Mathis Lebert. Yeah,
he was refusing to ride through, as he had every right to do, and as such, he was the last rider standing with Van Baarle. Okay, you know, he dropped the chain or something on the lead end of the mirror. I don't think that would have changed much in the long run. I think the mirror would have paid to his chances anyway, but still, you know, all the riders, had they taken notes, you know, basically the point I'm trying to make is that if Van Baarle is on a day like that, there is no sense in riding with him because you're just bringing him to the win. Which is not favoring your team in any way whatsoever. You know, in a situation like that, if you haven't got the legs to ride with him, don't ride with him. Don't deliver him to a win, a rival team to a win.
Lebert also, he finished 23rd, so he kind of hung on. You could see in that moment, he was kind of looking around, fighting, because he knew that whatever wheel he got over the top of that was likely where he would, you know, that was the group he's going to end up in at the finish line. And to finish 23rd after all that is still a pretty damn good ride for 21-year-old. Yeah, who I think most of us had probably never heard of before this weekend. I love little stories like that.
Me too.
Let's switch over to the women's race where the, well, it was a lot of Capecchi show, basically. And to some extent, the SD Works show. And I think that the major sort of takeaway out of this race was this sort of terrifying duo of Lotta Capecchi and Lorena Wiebes. I mentioned this off air before we hit record, but it's bad news when the best sprinter in the world, you can't get rid of her. And she just sits in the second group while your riders go up the road and you can't really do anything about it. So that's where the women's peloton is right now. And I don't really know how it's going to be a difficult thing to dethrone SD Works this spring, I think.
One thing I think that's really worth pointing out is just kind of a tip of the cap to this team. And I think there have been several times in the last, I don't know, 5 to 10 years where this squad, whatever it was called at the time, Bulls Dolmans are now SD Works, has been this dominant team. And as much as it, I think it can kind of put a stranglehold on the racing and it can kind of be, you know, not the most exciting when you feel like that's going to happen every race. I think the team deserves a lot of credit for really reinventing itself. They have over and over and over again gone out, gotten really, really talented riders, win everything, and then if they need to completely retool their, you know, the top of their roster. There are some riders who have been on this team for a really long time and have been a great part of this team for a while, but the very top, they keep refreshing with new talents, and right now it's Capecchi and Wiebes, and I think it's just really an impressive run of results for a team to keep doing it with new riders. So hats off to SD Works for finding a way, because right now this duo is just, yeah, like you said, I mean, when you can stick the best sprinter in the world in the second group, who's going to chase down the person who's off the front?
And I think there was one moment where that was so evident, was just between the Mur and the Bosberg. There's one stretch of road leading into the Bosberg there. It's sort of false flat. You have a technical section first, but then it opens up into a false flat, and it just needed one team to stick a couple of riders on the front there. And actually, when you fast forward to the finish, that could have been the difference between Capecchi staying away or not. But I think the other teams just looked around and said, well, we've got Lorena Wiebes sitting here. We're not, you know, if we ride now, we just set her up to take the sprint. And, you know, you go on to the Bosberg then, and Wiebes was phenomenal there, was like following the attacks on the Bosberg. And when you see that happening and you're in the chase group, all sort of motivation and momentum just falls out of that chase group then. And that's, as strong as Kopecky was, that was actually what made the difference in whether or not she stayed away, I think.
Group 2 syndrome.
Movistar had made some interesting tactical decisions throughout the day, actually. Not least of which was sending Arlena Sierra off the front solo for a while. She ended up getting caught by Kopecky and then dispatched relatively quickly. So behind, you had Movistar sitting there thinking, oh, we've got someone up the road. Oh, Lotta Kopecky's going to chase her down. Oh, there'll be a duo. So you've still got Movistar sitting behind, like Leanne Lippert just kind of cruising around the front of the field, not doing much. And then all of a sudden, he sort of committing the cardinal sin of getting dropped out of the winning breakaway is basically what Arlena Sierra did. And then Movistar, which, granted, Annemiek van Vleuten had a mechanical, mm-hmm. I think it was, on the mirror. But even so, they had then sort of boxed themselves into a corner where now you've just lost your advantage. You just lost your rider up the road. You don't really have the firepower to chase behind. And then you're stuck in the second group syndrome where you are sitting there next to Lorena Wiebes and don't know what to do with yourself.
I suppose to give them benefit of the doubt, had Van Vleuten not had the mechanical and follows Kopecky, and then it's Kopecky and Van Vleuten come across to Sierra, all of a sudden then they're in a great position. But, you know, it's not the way it worked out on Saturday for them.
Also, just a quick note. It's really cool that we're able to talk about Movistar doing stuff in the classics, period. I mean, even if we're talking about things they could have done better, I mean, this is a team that has, Van Vleuten, Aude Bjanik, and Sierra, and Norsgaard. The women's Movistar team is really good at the classics. The men's Movistar team is not. So it's nice that they have a team that is doing something up there. And it's cool that we were able to even criticize them because they were in a position to be criticized. So good on Movistar for at least putting one good classics team together.
Speaking of underrated classics teams, I liked watching in the men's race. I liked watching FDG give it a go all over the place. Stefan Kung and Lewis Askey, they were active. You know, like, I don't think that they quite had the firepower, but another team that's been, I think, relatively quiet for a while now and looks to be kind of on the brink of doing something interesting. Mm-hmm. Let's switch over to Kerna, Brussels Kerna. So, Dane, how did this one play out?
Differently and yet kind of the same. More tactically interesting. A lot more going on. Jumbo-Visma still crushed everybody and put two riders on the top two spots of the podium. This time it was Tish Van Oort in first, Nathan van Hooijdonk in second. What was he, 1 second behind? Nice job by Matej Mohoric to end up on the podium at least. Another Jumbo-Visma masterclass, just with different riders, different... sort of a different approach, and yet it kind of worked out the same.
So I want to hone in on just the finale here, because I think that's the most interesting bit from a tactics perspective. We actually had a question from a member. We already have a couple. Eric says, that move at the end was timed perfectly. I've never raced with a team, so I'm curious. Is that something they plan ahead or somehow communicate on the road? Or did Benoot just know when to go? We answer that question. So is that something that is coming from the director, is coming from a pre-race plan, or is that just lots and lots and lots of years of racing bikes and kind of just knowing when to do what?
I think there definitely would be a plan coming into the final. You know, if you've got two riders and a five-rider breakaway, the director will be giving them some instruction there. And most likely it was for Thijs Benoot to try... get solo off the front, and if it was coming down to a sprint to work for Van Hooijdonk, that would have been the general plan, I think. But what Benoot did coming on to that, you know, there's a 90 degree left hander with what, 500-600 meters to go, maybe slightly more than that. That was just pure instinct. Mm-hmm. He had positioned himself well at the back of the group. He was maybe thinking, I'll give it one last chance or something. Perhaps even, you know, just go for a long one, hoping that if somebody else chased, that sets up Van Hooijdonk better than Benoot could probably ever do. But if somebody else doesn't chase, then Benoot has a chance of winning. So the, you know, there's a couple of different ways it may have happened, but actually just positioning himself on the back of the group, coming around that left-hander and just, you know, attacking at that very second that he did, I think that was just pure instinct. And, you know, there was only enough gap for him to get through. If I remember correctly, he had, you know, positioned himself to actually take advantage of the tailwind. And it was just, you know, as he would have sensed a tiny lull, he just seemed to launch his attack, and it was just perfectly timed. And, you know, had it not been perfectly timed and somebody else was able to chase after him, that would have, as I said, set up Van Hooydonk. So it was almost a win-win. But, you know, that's often what riders don't see in teamwork, is that actually by playing the team tactic, you can give yourself a better chance of winning. And quite often people assume that if you're playing the team tactic, you're benefiting an older rider on your team. But quite often, actually, it's the underdog in that situation. Like one of the commentators said, coming around that final corner, there was nobody would have put their money on Benoot, and yet he's the rider who wins.
I mean, he looked the worst of anybody in that group. He looked just absolutely annihilated, and he probably was genuinely not the strongest one left, but it was all down to timing. There was an interesting, I think it was a tweet from Keir, one of the press folks over at EF, who he sent a tweet out about sort of art and science within a breakaway like that, and it reminded me that, or it brought to mind, so you've got like Taco van der Hoorn, who's like the science guy, right? He's the aero guy. He's wearing leg warmers with little ribs in them to get around the sock height rule. He's got his little crazy narrow handlebars. He's got all these things all about the breakaway and watts, basically. And then on the other side of that, you've got what's a bit of an art, which is just timing at the last possible second. And Tej Benoot, who artfully picked the exact moment he needed to go and ended up with a victory. And that's bike racing, right? Both are important. Both could have ended in a victory today, the art or the science. It was a bit of a win for art, I think, this time.
I think it's specifically the classics too. You get this cool classics, and, you know, maybe some climbing stages in stage races where working for the team or playing the team card does give you a chance. If you're a lead out man or woman, and you do a lead out for your sprinter, most of the time it's going to be your teammate that takes the win. But in a classics setting, and again, in certain very, you know,
if you win after doing a lead out, you're in trouble.
Yeah, you might be happy with the win, but your teammates did something wrong. Yeah, but yes. In a classic setting, you might be playing that card to get off the front and just see what happens. And you might win. And I think that's, to me, what makes the classic so fun, is that you can be a good teammate. You know, play that card off the front, attack from 60K out just to put someone off the front, and you might actually win. And that doesn't often happen in other kinds of races.
Mm-hmm. I also feel like this race felt like, to me, almost as much as, yes, Tej Benoot won it, but it's more that everyone else lost. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I think that's a really important distinction to make, because like if you looked at like Wellens and you looked at Mohoric and you looked at Van der Hoorn, like they were all kind of paralyzed by this. Like one would chase something down, like Mohoric chased it down like a million times and just burnt his candle. And like, what else was he? But people are like, well, what else is he supposed to do? Otherwise, it's going to go away. But anyway, just to talk about him for like 20 seconds as the Slovenian guy, like all of this, I think, so Mohoric at the end of last season said that his main goal for the year is Paris-Roubaix. All of this is like a laboratory for Paris-Roubaix for him. And I think it should be understood that that's really what he's kind of aiming at. You know, it shows that he can like kind of cook, you know what I mean?
His interview after the race, I thought, was the most informative of any of the interviews that were given. In fact, actually, I grabbed the audio from it, so I'm going to drop a couple seconds of it in here.
But we waited for the last bit after the turn, for the last 800 meters, and when Tish went, I could have maybe closed the gap, but then I knew I would take someone with me, and they would probably flick me for the podium as well, so I couldn't do everything myself. Maybe Taco was gambling a little bit too much.
Everybody was waiting for an attack from Taco.
Everybody was waiting for an attack for Taco, but I saw that he wasn't pulling committed like all of us, like all of the others. So I was expecting a big attack, but he should have, if he wanted to win, he should have reacted to Tish. because I couldn't do everything on my own. No, and they were also looking a lot at me because they knew I was maybe fast in the sprint. But at the end, also Nathan beat me in the sprint. So, yeah, chapeau.
I didn't hear that interview, but it's interesting to hear that because watching it, it was as if Taco was trying to force the exact scenario that Tanis Benoot let happen. And he was trying to maneuver himself into the perfect position and trying to wait for the right moment. And, you know, when you're trying that hard, it very rarely works. Whereas Benoot didn't really have time to think about it. He just felt it and did it, which is totally out of character for Benoot, because usually he does the opposite and like just rides on the front until someone beats him. But this time he did it perfectly. But I want to go back a second, Kate. You had said that, you know, others lost the race, and I can't really blame anybody in the break for the way the finale unfolded. It, you know, somebody has to win, somebody has to lose. But the teams I thought that threw the race away, were the sprinters teams who, like, for 50, 60 kilometers, granted the breakaway only had 1 minute, but in a race like these classic races, 1 minute may as well be 10 minutes. You have to commit. And time after time, we've seen sprinters teams come up with one rider to try to contribute to the chase. And it just, you know, it wasn't working. Coupled with the fact that all these teams know that that finishing circuit around Kurna is so difficult to get a chase organized. And, you know, we've seen Quickstep with one rider up at a time. Trek put Toms up there, Sacrificial Lamb, to chase on his own. Bora, I think at one point, had a rider or two up there. You know, really what they needed to do was, when they came out of the hill zone, commit, bring the break back to 20, 30 seconds. Okay, it might have caused more chaos in the long run, but with the five riders you had up front there, if that wasn't closed as quickly as possible, that was not coming back. And that's ultimately what we've seen.
I do think I kind of understand why they didn't, and I think you got to give your tip of your cap to Jumbo, because who did win the sprint for sixth in the group? It was Jumbo. So at the end of the day, either way, you're going to lose. And Jumbo, I think, played it perfectly once again with the talents that they had to, they won out of the break. They took second. And then in the sprint, if, you know, whoever was left over, they won that too. So,
And, you know, obviously Jumbo were phenomenal this weekend. And we're all talking about Van Baarle and Thijs Benoot and Van Hooydonk and Van Aert yet to come and all their superstars. But actually, I think one of the biggest signings they've had is Jan Traknik, the other Slovenian in the race. He, you know, over the both days, he was just phenomenal. I would argue he's probably the wrong rider to be following the counter moves in the finale on the Het Nieuwsblad, but still he was there. And actually, when you look around, you just think of the difference Jan Traknik could have made for a team like Bahrain. He's obviously left Bahrain, but they were having Fred Wright do the job that Jan Traknik would not only normally do, but do better. And then the likes of Fred Wright, who, you know, legitimately could be going for results in his races, doesn't have an option to go for results because he spent his legs doing Jan Traknik's job. And, you know, Traknik is now at Jumbo-Visma. He was actually in the five-rider move. He did the bulk of the work to drive it clear, and then still finishes in the chasing peloton right behind. And yesterday, as I said, he was following counter moves. You know, arguably, you want one of your stronger favorites. You want the likes of Thijs Benoot or someone in those counter moves coming in the finale of Umloop. But, you know, as you said, Kelly, Thijs was probably the weakest in that front group today. And actually, we could see that yesterday on the Mur. Also, he really struggled on the Mur, missed a couple of splits, and just about came back to the front. So, you know, perhaps that was playing on all the riders' minds as well, is that Thijs isn't in the kind of form we've seen previously.
Isn't that the best thing about bike racing,
though? Yes.
Is that he's off form. Like, he's not as good as he has been in the past, and this is the time that he wins a major race. Like, I love that about this, particularly this time of year. Like, the classics are perfect for that. You still have to be good.
Yes.
let's be really clear. He's probably, and he would probably admit this, he's probably at like 97% out of 100, right? And he's probably been better. We've seen him be better. And yet this is the time that, you know, a bit of artistry and he gets across the line.
But I think when Benoot is in better form, that's when he then disengages the brain.
Stupid.
Yes. And just like, you know, tries to ride all of them on the Pet Nieuwsblad on the front and ride everybody off his wheel. Whereas when he's at 97%, that just isn't an option. And yet he wins Kurna. And the other thing, you mentioned that he was sort of the artful writer in the breakaway, but I think he actually doesn't even realize that he's a scientist, because he, despite all Taco's tricks, Benoot is probably the most arrow in that break, having had his shoulder surgically removed. You know, there's just, he is undoubtedly the most arrow rider in that breakaway, I think, despite all Taco's tricks.
All right, I wanna move on. We have sort of two more things to talk about, and we're nearing the hour here. So, we have more Yumbo. We can't exit this podcast without mentioning the fact that Jonas Vingegaard won every available stage of O Gran Camino, including the time trial at the end, and that means we've got Vingegaard and Pogacar headed toward Paris-Nice starting on the 5th, both having won most of their races.
They're going to kill each other, man. They're going to come out guns blazing. This is what we wanted from the Roglic-Pogacar rivalry that never happened.
Right?
Never happens.
100%.
Now we get it. And it's like, yeah, no, these guys want a race. They want a race. They want to beat the shit out of each other. Like, and it's like, hell yeah, bring it on, finally. Jesus.
I summed up very well.
Thank you.
I cannot express any more excitement for Paris-Nice. I did think it was worth mentioning that fact. I don't think we have a whole lot to add at that point. And frankly, I think we have another episode before Paris-Nice even starts. So we'll leave that for now. But Vingegaard, worth a mention.
And the drone.
For absolutely dumb. And okay, we can talk about the drone.
The worst footage I've ever seen.
On this podcast previously, we were talking about how awesome the drone footage from the Cyclocross World Championships was, and how cool it would be if they used it in select areas in professional road racing. They did that, and it was
seasick,
less than ideal. It made me seasick. Like, for some reason, the drone operator decided that we needed to sort of hover. We needed to move up and down by about 8 feet on a regular basis, and also to the left and right at the same time.
Like, I don't know if he was drunk.
And it was awful.
Like, or that he didn't know how to operate a drone. But, like, also the camera they had on that was, like, I swear I had a better camera on my cell phone in 2010. Like, just total disaster across the board.
I think the drone just realized this was its 15 seconds of fame, because there was one point where the drone was actually on our screens because it was hovering in front of the moto camera. It was just like, I'm on TV. Look, I'm on TV.
I would have been so pissed if I was in the road, man. I would have been like, get this thing out of my face, right, man.
It's not even offering an
so
arrow.
That's
benefit.
How not to do it.
Like, it should be bigger if you want that. Yeah.
It might even be the opposite. It might be blowing air at him.
Yeah.
I think. Anyway. How not to do it. Footage of this is floating around the internet if you haven't seen it. I think, Kate, you tweeted it at some point or retweeted it. Anyway, go check it out because it's terrible. And please don't do that again. If you're going to do drone footage, can we just get like a relatively static following the rider kind of shot, as opposed to following a rider from the inside of a boat on the high seas? I did not really enjoy that particular aspect of it. Last on our list today, Pac just released a helmet with cargo nets. I don't know how else to describe them. With cargo nets on the side of it. I'm sure you've seen this. It's probably popped up on some of the websites that actually exist right now. I just thought I'd open the floor with a question. What would you put in your helmet, cargo nets, if you had to put something in them?
Speaker. I'm going to blast music going up left-hand canyon. And I want it right by my ear, but I also want everybody else to hear it. That's my plan.
So everybody else hates you, Dane?
Yeah, that's what I want. That's what I'm going for. To be fair, though, I did a big event last year, and it was a big, massive ride, and there were people riding around with speakers. And assuming the music was good, it was actually pretty fun. Depending on the vibe, depending on the sort of ride, I think it can be okay. Usually not.
Going up left hand on a 60-degree Sunday early in the year when there's like 1,000 people going up it, that could be kind of fun.
Yeah,
a little party atmosphere.
Exactly.
All right. Kate, what would you put in your helmet cargo?
A shot of Fireball. Like one of those little tiny bottles. I don't know. Fireball is the funniest liquor I could think of, but yeah, it's like, man, when you're really not having it.
I feel like if you were riding up with Fireball with Kate and me, and we had speakers and booze. That sounds like a really fun ride to me, actually.
I know. That's the spirit of gravel. Great.
Yeah. Running?
Sausages?
Any particular like a hot Italian, or what are we thinking here?
Dardis.
I don't know what that is.
their local delicacy. It's our local
sausage.
Would
you put 8 pounds in a 7 pound bag?
I was trying to remember Kaylee's quote from earlier. I couldn't quite remember exactly what it was. So.
I think that was the correct.
I think it was 9.
It was 8.9. It was 8.9.
Yeah, oh, 8.9.
It was a sausage in an 8 pound bag.
It was the empirical measurement units that had thrown me. I could remember the numbers, but I didn't remember what the weight was.
Right. Okay.
But
it could be not. He could be 9 kilos of sausage in it.
That's a lot of sausage.
Kilo bag. Yeah. That works too. That works too.
But the reason, there's actually a reason I would choose a sausage. And that is, I think adding something softer would be fine, but adding in something hard like a beverage bottle or a speaker could actually be dangerous. Adding something like that onto your helmet should you crash onto it. I often see GoPro cameras on helmets, and that really freaks me out.
I feel like having a cargo net on your helmet probably isn't the best thing. I mean, I'm just thinking like, you're riding through the woods and your helmet catches a tree branch just whips off to the side.
I think
the whole thing is a little bit questionable.
I think it's just for show mostly. I don't think it's actually intended to carry anything, is it?
No, I think it's just like tactical gear signifiers or something like that. The same way that like people who work in an office wear like Gore-Tex boots. It's like you work at Salesforce. Where are you hiking?
I know we have listeners that work at Salesforce. Please take a look at your footwear and let us know whether you are Kate.
My husband's a programmer, and
where I live, it's the people that like leave skis or a kayak on their roof all year. Very similar kind of vibe. Yeah, bit silly. The cargo net helmet. I think that's a fun place to end.
I think
today.
I think it's just jumping on the bandwagon. Wasn't it Porsche who recently released the Dakar Rally 911? It's like, yeah, those things went together in the 80s.
Really,
they don't
silly.
Really go together now for consumers who drive on the road, not in a desert. And this is just similar, I think. It's like the Ford Fiesta Active. It's got like bumpers on it, on the side of it and stuff. It's like, why? Why?
It's Gorpcore. That's what they call it in fashion. Where like Rihanna's Super Bowl shoes, you know, which are like Salomon sneakers with like a drawstring. And it's like, it's Gorpcore. Good old raisins and peanuts core.
Oh, that Gorp. I was like, what is Gorp? Gorp, like the food.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I got you. All right. We're leaving this
behind. Yeah. On the note of Gorpcore.
I learned a lot in the last 30 seconds, actually. I'm happy with this.
We have to mention at least one helmet we don't like per week. So with that reminder, if you like this podcast and you want it to continue to exist, again, this is an existential question here. We will literally disappear if we don't get enough members. Head over to escapecollective.cc. Sign up. Make sure you read the site. Make sure you read the FAQs. If you click find out more right at the top, make sure you read through all those. It answers a lot of questions. If you have even more questions, well, you're welcome to hit me up. You can direct message me anywhere. I'm at Kaylee Fretz on all the things. Or you can sign up and then DM me on the Discord, whatever you want to do. Thank you in advance. Myself, Wade, the whole crew here, everybody that we're trying to get involved in this, we all thank you, because without you, this won't work. It just won't. All right. We'll be back next week with another placeholder episode, and later this week, in fact, with another geek warning. So we'll be back in a couple days, Ronan and I, for the rest of you. See you in a week. Bye-bye.